Okay, let's resume our agenda. The time is 10:07 a.m. The by the way, agenda item number 2, which we skipped over, my understanding is the proponents will not be here, so I'm going to lay that over to the end of this morning's agenda and move on then to number 125, education funding. And Mr. Domenico, I'll turn it over to you.
On 125 and 126, which both relate to essentially the same topic, the Attorney General has already taken a public position on the matter, and so therefore has asked me as his representative on the board to recuse myself from consideration of 125 and 126. So the Attorney General won't have a representative for those two.
Thank you. So we still have a quorum with Mr. Carton and myself sitting as a title board. I'd like to hear first from proponents. Again, we'll follow the usual procedure. We'll find out if there's questions about the measure and then move to that step one. Step two will be determining whether the board has jurisdiction and including whether the measure complies with the single subject requirement. And then step three, if the board has jurisdiction, we'll look at the staff prepared drafts. Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the board. My name is Blaine Myrie. I'm with Isaacson Rosenbaum here on behalf of the opponents in both 125 and 126. And what 125 is, I think the staff draft at least indicates, is it's proposal to amend the Constitution concerning the manner in which the state funds public education from preschool through the 12th grade. The core of that is the creation of an education fund savings account within the state education fund, and the measure provides a mechanism for funding that savings account, for authorizing the expenditures from that savings account, and also allows for transfers to the state education fund, frees up the state education fund from certain obligations regarding general fund. So that's the general purpose behind this state education fund measure. Open it up for questions.
Are there questions for the proponents? Mr. Murray, I'm just sort of reviewing my notes about the measure. So the reference in the measure to the Strategic Transportation Project Investment Program, that, what is that? Is that from Referendum C, or did that, what is that referring to? Is it in statute now?
I'm sorry. I'm trying to remember the legislative council. It's Senate Bill 1.
Oh, okay. I guess I don't have any other questions. So then let's turn to consideration of whether the measure comprises a single subject. So I want to see if anybody wants to testify on that question. Mr. Bruce, did you want to comment on that question? I don't have anyone else besides Mr. Bruce signed up at this point.
Douglas Bruce, good morning. I don't believe that this is a single subject. It's one of the reasons that I'm here. It's not a single subject for several reasons, one of which is the subject that's listed in the staff draft, I think, is highly misleading and conceals from the voters what part of this measure is about. And also, also the provision that the chairman just mentioned, throwing in transportation funding, is an overt attempt at what's called a Christmas tree ordinance, not ordinance, a Christmas tree measure, or log rolling. And I'd refer your attention to the language of 140.106.5, subsection 1 and 2, that the purposes for the single subject rule were to prevent incongruous measures in the same subject, especially the practice of putting together in one measure subjects having no necessary or proper connection for the purpose of enlisting in support of the measure the advocates of each measure, and thus securing the enactment of measures that could not be carried upon their merits. And Roman numeral 2, under paragraph E, to prevent surreptitious measures and apprise the people of the subject of each measure by the title, that is, to prevent surprise and fraud from being practiced upon voters. This measure is overtly for the purpose of gathering the support of the people who want money for roads. This is not about education funding. That's just an add-on there. That's another special interest group that is being enlisted to support this measure as part of a deal. And that kind of log rolling deal is not permissible under Article 5, Section 1, Subsection 5.5, or the statutory reference that I indicated. There is no logical connection to having this measure, in effect, guarantee transportation funding as a precondition for this education funding. So I object to it on that grounds. I also object, some of this will come out when we get to the discussion of the title, but it says public education. I think we all have a comprehension what education is, but there is another category apart from public education that is shown in the text of 125. Page 1 of the text, section 17, 1B, the capitalized one says for public education from preschool through the 12th grade. And then there's another category for categorical programs. That term categorical programs is not defined. It's my impression, even though obviously it's not in the current list of recipients of this fund, for the state education fund, you have an undefined term here. I don't believe you can set a title and find a single subject if you don't know what the meaning of the proposal is. If the board cannot understand the meaning of the proposal, and it's insufficient to just have a representation here orally by the proponent as to what he meant to say, if it isn't in the proposal. But the categorical programs, is my understanding, it includes things like lunch programs, which is nutrition, not education. It includes school buses, which don't educate anybody, various other programs. I don't know what else is included, and we are left to guess, and you are not allowed to guess. You can only draw your conclusion from the text of the measure. And I see nothing in the text of this measure that defines categorical program, which is one of the two things that is listed as the recipient of the money, yet the proposed ballot title says only about funding public education on line 2. So I think that is a deficiency. I don't think it can be corrected just by inserting those words, for which no meaning is provided, into the title. I think if you rule against me on this point, then I still think you have to put that in the title, because that's one of the two things that was specifically inserted on page 1 of the text. The other concern that I have in terms of single subject grounds is that the reference to in effect repealing state excess revenue refunds forever, is buried on line 8 of the text. You don't even say the taxpayer's Bill of Rights. You're assuming that the average citizen will whip out his copy of the state constitution and know what you're talking about. You don't say anything about excess revenue. You don't say anything about eliminating forever all state refunds of excess revenue. That's not disclosure, and I understand to some extent I'm overlapping into the title, but I think it's relevant to what the real subject and purpose of this measure is. The purpose of this measure is, apart from education funding, it is to take away all state refunds of excess revenue forever. And I don't think that that can fail to be part of the title, even though I think that that makes it, frankly, two subjects. And this proposal was heralded as a compromise by the Speaker of the House, who is present here, as a way to supposedly sever the Gordian knot of how you can fund education and make a ostentatious but misleading sacrifice of part of Amendment 23 and then bring it back through the back door by taking away Tabor excess refunds forever. That kind of compromise and patchwork and piecing things together is exactly what the single subject rule was designed to prevent. I think that this measure has to be split into two. You have to have one measure talking about giving up Tabor excess refunds forever, have that clearly be the title, and specify that it's the taxpayer's Bill of Rights, not Article 10, Section 20, that people don't know, and it would be a separate measure to provide sources of funding for education. But I don't think that something that significant can just be buried in the text and not be considered part of the purpose and the intent, goal, and subject of the measure. The Supreme Court has said, in particular with petitions, even though I don't agree, they have evolved their definition into, from a, just a pure single subject rule according to the standards of the legislature, which is what we were sold in 1994 with Referendum A, and they have had a creep in that we now have a single purpose rule. Well, the single purpose of this rule is not simply to spend more money on education, because it also includes categorical programs, which are unspecified. It could be an open-ended means of spending money on anything, education or otherwise. We don't even know what a categorical program can include. But to say that, I mean, in effect, you've got really three subjects here. You've got funding for education, you've got funding for categorical programs, and you've got repeal forever of the spending limits, of the state spending limits, in effect, by having unlimited spending, because all you're doing is saying that the excess revenue is spent on some other form of state spending. So really, it's sort of like the Byrd-Arbuckle measure. Any overage above a certain percentage amount still is spent by the state. It's just spent on capital construction and other things. But in this case, you're saying unlimited state spending forever, but you aren't disclosing that. And it's not only should be clearly disclosed, I think it constitutes a separate subject. It's not necessarily connected to this measure. They can have state spending otherwise without wiping out a controversial provision of the Constitution without full disclosure that has, in a five-year period in the late 90s, returned $3.4 billion to the citizens of Colorado, and which resulted in a very controversial measure in 2005 called Referendum C, where the state understated the amount it wanted to keep and is now keeping close to $6 billion. And that's in the news repeatedly. And to just say that, well, this really isn't the subject or purpose of this measure, it's just a footnote or an incidental part of this measure, I think that that is highly misleading, and therefore I object to this on single subject grounds for the reasons stated.
Questions for Mr. Bruce? Let me ask a couple questions, Representative Bruce. Excuse me. Your comments about the definition of categorical programs, I wanted to understand that a little bit better. The measure uses that in new language, but it also repeals in subsection 1 of section 17, repeals language that has that term in it. That's the required inflationary increases in state appropriations for the statewide per pupil funding and for categorical programs. So I think you're correct, it's not defined, but is there really any need to define it since it's already used in the Constitution?
It's used but repealed. And where is it defined? You have to deal with this measure now. I would have raised the same objection at the time. There is no definition in Amendment 23, which is Section 17, of what a categorical program is. So,
well, excuse me for interrupting. Mr. Carton is pointing out to me that there is a definition in Section 17.
Where is that?
In subsection 2, there's a definition section.
Okay, so you're saying that we should assume that what they struck out in the first paragraph and put in the third paragraph is the same thing?
I would think so, because that definition would still apply to all of section 17, I think.
And that is Article
9, I assume.
That's section what of?
Article 9, section 17.
And where is the definition?
Subsection 2.
I was looking, I didn't pick up that it had been repealed above. I was just looking at his new language, and I asked Mr. Gruskin, who was supposedly here representing him, where there was a definition, and if there was a definition, he said no. Okay. Well, I noticed from the definition, it's a definition that is still an open-ended definition, because it ends by saying other current and future accountable programs specifically identified in statute. So we're creating something that allows the legislature to call anything a categorical program. It doesn't even say, for education, as I pointed out, it does say transportation programs, which I don't think is educational. Small attendance center, health, well, I guess health education is supposedly education, but it is still open-ended in terms of we're approving a constitutional amendment that allows the legislature to spend the money on anything which is not necessarily education. And yet the title and the subject is supposedly education funding, not transportation funding for the general public or transportation funding for school buses, or whatever the legislature decides, which is not a limit. If it's not a limit on what the money can be spent on, it's not really a single subject of education funding, because this allows the legislature to spend it on anything that by statute, without voter approval, they wish to spend it on. In other words, to expand and twist the definition of categorical program that's in the Constitution now.
And I wanted
that
to.
Troubles me.
I wanted to actually. My.
By the way,
I wanted
you
to follow
up
on.
You have very poor acoustics here. You might, in the future, think about having a microphone system. I know you have a tape recorder, but I can barely hear you. So.
Okay, I'll try to speak up. I wanted to focus on the transportation program aspect of this, and I'm trying to understand. I understand the theoretical argument that that could be a log rolling situation to enlist support of those that support increased transportation funding. But I want to understand the measure a little bit better in that context. It looks to me like it comes up in subsection 7, the transfers from the general fund subsection. And just for the sake of argument, let me take one run at this from the single subject point of view, and then you can contrast this for me, and I think I'll understand your argument a little bit better. If the measure really is about education funding, and the first part of it seems like it pretty clearly is, then when you get to subsection 7, what that seems to be about is that the General Assembly may also, in addition to the other funding mechanisms that are provided for, may also transfer monies from the general fund to the state education fund. But the limitation is, and this is where the transportation comes in, I think, the limitation is that can only be done, I think, if the, and this is paragraph B, but only if the condition is met in paragraph B about fully funding HUTF transfers, I think, under Senate Bill 1. So, in other words, it is connected to increased funding from the general fund. It's a condition. It's not increased funding for transportation, as I understand it.
Well, it's overt log rolling, which is not allowed. You could say transportation. You could say guaranteed funding also for parks and every other program, and have this misleading thing that you think you're getting some money, but you're protecting all the other programs. It doesn't have to be limited to transportation. It could be every other program in the state. It could be health care. It could be everything. And that kind of buy-off, I don't think, is consistent with the intent and the spirit of the single subject rule. Furthermore, Senate Bill 1, by definition, is a statute, and the statute can be changed. So even if people think that they're being misled to think that it's money that is pursuant to laws required to be spent, it's not necessarily incorporating the current statute, because this current statute can be changed. Senate Bill 1 could be repealed, it could be expanded, it could be watered down. And so, you know, it's highly misleading, but it's put in there as a sop to the transportation wing of the electorate. I don't think it's a surprise to this board that Republicans generally like more spending on roads, capital construction, and Democrats like more spending on government education systems. And this is the trade-off that they're making for purposes of mollifying Republican opposition to having unlimited spending, which is what this would provide, going all for education. Because it's saying it's a trade-off. It won't go all for education. It'll only go for education if we honor the Senate bill statutory provision. But that statutory provision can be changed. That statutory provision is not locked in, and it isn't locked. Today's language is not locked in to paragraph B on page 3 of the text.
Okay. Other questions for Representative Bruce? No, thank you. Is there anybody else? I don't have anybody else signed up to testify on. Is there anybody else who wishes to comment on the single subject question with respect to number 125? If not, Mr. Murray, would you like to respond to the arguments about single subject?
What I heard were that this contains three distinct purposes. I think you parse them down. It all connects to the single purpose of education funding. Mr. Bruce identified three purposes: funding for education, funding for categorical programs, which, as Mr. Carton pointed out, is defined already in the Constitution. It does contain a definition that is educational programs. So right there, the first two purposes collapse into education funding. And the third purpose was to have refunds go to state education funding. State education funding is the core of each of Mr. Bruce, or Representative Bruce's three identified purposes, and that is a single purpose, a single subject under the statute and under the constitutional requirement. To address the transportation issue, I think, Mr. Chair, you pointed out correctly that this is a limitation on circumstances under which the General Assembly may make the appropriation under new Section 7A. And that's all it is. And that is consistent with education funding.
And there is no additional funding for transportation in this measure. Is that correct?
That's correct. It doesn't guarantee any additional funding for
If we get to the titles, you know, one of the requirements is that the board is required to clearly express the single subject. The staff drafts expresses that as the manner in which state funds the manner in which the state funds public education from preschool through 12th grade. The theme of it being public education funding, I think, is that a fair statement of your view of what the single subject of the measure is?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you. Mr. Bruce, briefly, if you'd be very brief, please.
Thank you. I just want to point out just one comment in response. If categorical programs and educational spending are the same thing, why was it stricken in the first paragraph and affirmatively added in the third paragraph if it all has to do with educational funding? The general rule of construction of statutes and the Constitution is that each word has a separate meaning. You cannot disregard certain words or assume that they're just synonyms for something else. He's saying that it's really just a synonym, but they affirmatively, in capital letters, added categorical programs. And that categorical programs definition that he mentioned specifically says, as you see in the Constitution, that it's anything else that the General Assembly wants to spend the money on. The definition doesn't even say anything of an educational nature that the General Assembly wants to spend money on. So the categorical program could be about health care for young people or who knows what. It's totally open-ended. Therefore, if it's open-ended and it's not limited to education funding, and they didn't think when drafting it was limited to education funding because they put in categorical programs separately as one of the two new additional recipients of the revenue. If it's open-ended, then it can't be fairly described as being limited to funding public education.
Okay, thank you. Board discussion on the question of whether the measure complies with a single subject requirement. Mr. Cardin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate and understand Representative Bruce's arguments with regard to the transportation and the TABOR refund aspect of the measure. And I'm also cognizant of Section 140, 106.5, and the provisions of Section 1 and Article 5 on single subject. I feel as though the measure contains a single subject. Notwithstanding the couple of perhaps what might be stated as different purposes. First of all, categorical programs is defined in the Constitution, in the section of the Constitution that this measure amends. I think that and that definition is used in subsection 1 of Section 17. And is restated in the amended language in subsection 4B of the proponent's measure. I think that, and I the way I understand it and believe it's a reasonable interpretation, given the staff draft, the title as stated, the manner in which the state funds public education, I think that categorical programs, it's reasonable to conclude, can be reasonably understood as part of public education, as a category of public education. unnecessarily, I think subsumes the wrong word, but I think it's we can talk about this when we get to the title, but I'm not sure it's completely necessary to specify categorical programs in the statement of the single subject in addition to public education. I think that public education may suffice. In looking at 140.106.5, again, 106.5.1A1 prohibits the joinder of incongruous subjects in the same petition, quote, especially the practice of putting together in one measure subjects having no necessary or proper connection. One tenet of relevant case law in this area is that the Constitution and statute prohibit initiatives from containing two or more subjects, separate and discrete subjects that are not dependent upon or necessarily connected with each other. And I won't go to great lengths here, but it seems to me that the provisions relating to transportation that reference transportation, Senate Bill 1 transfers in subsection 7, B of the measure, and the amendment to section 20 of Article 10 providing for excess revenues, for the transfer of excess revenues to the state education fund, these provisions relate to or are connected with the modifications to the language of Amendment 23 that change the funding mechanism going forward. And so, in kind of going back to, and I understand Representative Bruce's arguments regarding 140.106.5, but I think the single subject standard is met with this measure. The cases also say we must examine an initiative's central theme to determine whether it contains hidden purposes under a broad theme. I'm not seeing any. I think all the purposes of this measure are fairly straightforward, that they're congruous, that they relate to a central theme. And I would support the board moving forward to setting a title for this measure.
And I agree. I think a fair understanding of the measure leads me to the extent that I've got one, it understands that it's about education funding, public education funding. And I think for the reasons you've articulated, Mr. Carton, I think it's a single subject. So I'll go ahead and move that the board find that the measure is a single subject and proceed to set titles.
Second.
There's no other discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 2-0. Then let's turn to the staff draft. Representative Bruce.
I would like to raise by questions two other matters of potential jurisdiction.
Okay, that's in order. Go ahead.
Thank you. The first is, I'm looking at the material that is provided here. I did not attend the review and comment hearing, but there were some changes from the draft that I saw that was subject to the review and comment hearing, and I would like to inquire if the board has examined those changes and has examined the questions and wishes to make a specific finding as to whether or not all the changes from the draft submitted for review and comment hearing under the constitutional requirement were in response directly to questions of the members of conducting the review and comment hearing, the staff members, or whether or not the board has found that there are matters that are not subject to questions, which I think would require a new hearing. So that's the first of my two questions.
I haven't looked at it, but you're welcome to raise it. And which particular changes are you questioning, whether they are in response to the staff comments?
As I said, Mr. Chairman, I did not attend the review and comment hearing. So I know that there were specific questions which were asked, and that this is not the same version that was presented to them. So I think it's incumbent upon the board to make a determination, fulfilling the constitutional requirement, that there was nothing put in here that was not in response to the questions at that public hearing.
I think ordinarily we've been open to objections to the board's jurisdiction where opponents have raised questions about particular changes that they argued were not in response. So you're welcome to do that. But in the absence of that, I'm willing to presume that the changes are in response to the staff comments.
I'll reserve then that objection for an appeal.
Okay.
The other matter in the packet that was presented here today, there is a cover letter from Isaacson Rosenbaum, D.C., and it says the required drafts of 125 and 126, since there was an original, presumably a revised and final, I'd like to inquire if the public record in your file shows that there were all three for each of the two petitions.
I believe there were, and they're also posted on the Secretary of State's website.
Okay. I just wanted to raise that issue because that is a legal requirement.
Thank you. Then Ms. Gomez has displayed on the screen the staff draft for the proposed titles. Mr. Murray, have you had a chance to look at the staff draft? Do you have any comments?
I have, Mr. Chairman. And I work with Mr. Gruskin. I'm handing a... the revised one. Unlike Mr. Gruskin, I remember the number of the lines.
Representative Bruce. Thank you.
And the changes on the staff draft, I've tried to do a couple things in my revision. The first goal is to make it shorter. I think there's a lot to this initiative and a lot that does need to be included in the title, but to the extent we can make it as short as possible, I think that's a goal that we all share. What I have also done in this draft, however, is to reorder things in what I think is a more logical sequence for two reasons. And let me explain the changes first, and then I'll explain the reasoning. They're essentially after the looking at staff draft line three. Line two, where after the single subject statement it begins in connection therewith. There are essentially after that eight clauses, and those eight clauses specify really what the overarching meat of the proposal is. And to that end, if you look at the initiative as a whole, the core of what it does is create this state education fund savings account within the existing state education fund. And I think it's four of the eight clauses address specifically the state education fund savings account. Or actually, it may even be five of them. Trying to think of the best way to go through this, but if you look at my revised draft, what I have done is take what I think is the logical sequence of placing the five clauses having to do with the savings account and put them up first. So after in connection therewith, the next clause is creating a state education fund savings account in the state education fund. And that's kind of the core of this initiative, and everything else flows from the creation of that savings account. The second, and I have altered the language a little bit, and of course we can address that as well, crediting a portion of state education fund monies to the savings account in certain circumstances. That's about funding from the state education fund this newly created savings account. So I think logically those two should come first. Three then talks about establishing the purposes for which monies in the savings account may be spent. You've created and now funded this savings account, and now you're specifying the purposes for which that money may be spent. Number four, specifying when the money in the savings account may be spent. It may be that number three and four could be collapsed into a single clause, making this title even shorter, something like establishing the purposes for which money in the savings account may be spent or the circumstances under which. But those two, again, 3 and 4, then address talking about how the money is spent out of the savings account. And then number 5 in my draft, which starts at line 7 of my draft, establishing a maximum amount that may be in the savings account in any state fiscal year. So it sets the ceiling of funding in the state savings account. So those 5 provisions all address the creation, funding, expenditures from, and the spending cap, or the cap on the amount of funds in the savings account. So I think logically those should all go in sequence. And since it's the core of the initiative, it should go up front. There's also, and so after that are the other 3 clauses that address, that don't address specifically the savings account, but address the state education fund. The 6th one in my draft, which begins on line 8, is allowing the General Assembly to transfer monies to the state education fund, notwithstanding any limitation on annual general fund appropriations, so long as certain obligations for transportation funding are met. Again, that's the Section 7 of the initiative and the 7B limitation on when the General Assembly may authorize the transfer of funds to the state education fund from the general fund. And then the last 2 provisions, number 7, for the 2010-11 state fiscal year and each state fiscal year thereafter, transferring any state revenues in excess of the constitutional limit on state fiscal year spending to the state education fund. That's essentially what Representative Bruce was talking about, wanting to have the Tabor language in, and where the staff draft had in the Article 10, Section 20 language. We have just simplified that to the constitutional limit on state fiscal year spending, which I think is doesn't require the voters to go into the statute books and look at that, but to understand that there is a constitutional limit in place. And finally, the last provision then would be what is the first in the draft now, eliminating the increased funding requirement for public schools contained in Section 17 of Article 9 of the Colorado Constitution. That's what is the first clause in the staff draft, although it's in different language. The reason these last two provisions are at the end is they come later chronologically in how the initiative operates. 1 through 5 and 6, the State Education Fund creation and management of the funds and the funding of that, along with the provision allowing the General Assembly to transfer funds to the State Education Fund, those are all effective, I believe, in its 2009-10 fiscal year. The provision addressing excess revenues is effective in the 2010-11 state fiscal year. And the final provision, the eliminating the increased funding requirement, that addresses and repeals a provision that went into effect or would have gone into effect in the 2011 and 12 fiscal year. And so I think logically and chronologically it makes sense to reorder it in this way, and I think that my revised draft has taken a good draft that the staff provided and made it a little bit easier for the voters to get a handle on and to understand the core purpose and operation of the initiative.
Thank you. I guess I you've identified, I think, kind of a fundamental question about how do we set titles for this, is kind of what is the proper arrangement of the different provisions. And I'm not quite with you, I guess, on your suggested arrangement. And I don't think it really should be chronological. I think we really do need to consider kind of what's most important and what, you know, I think we need to prioritize, you know, the things that that prioritize the title based on the things that are perhaps most notable, for lack of a better phrase. And I guess rather than focusing on the details and argue with my language here a little bit because it might reflect an incomplete understanding of the proposal, but it seems like the details about the savings account are relatively minor compared to, for example, the allocation of Tabor refunds for education funding. I mean, to me, that seems like a fundamental thing that voters need to know, is that instead of TABOR refunds, those monies would go for education funding. And to me, that is kind of the core of this. I mean, and I guess it, at least in my mind, there's two provisions that are connected. There's the repeal of the language requiring annual inflationary increases in appropriations for education. And granted, those don't take effect for a little while, but it's repealing the mandated inflationary increases in appropriations, but providing instead for the allocation of TABOR refunds. That seems to me that is the kind of the heart of this proposal. And the savings account to me is of less importance. And in fact, I also think that the general fund appropriations, depending on Senate Bill 1, is also a relatively minor provision compared to the application of TABOR refunds for education funding. So I think we do need to decide the correct order of the provisions of the title, but I think I probably disagree with what you're suggesting that order should be.
Let me make another suggestion. I mean, as we all understand, the overarching goal is to have a fair and accurate title. And I think that the way the staff draft is written now, the first clause talks about eliminating the requirement for the 2011-12 state fiscal year and each state fiscal year thereafter, the statewide base per pupil funding for public education, et cetera. It's language which, blunt, doesn't really jump off the page, you know, as to what this is all about. I think creation of the single subject statement says concerning the manner in which the state funds public education, and then I think, as I stated, the core of how it accomplishes that is by the creation of the state education savings fund. But I think also in terms of providing clarity for the voters, That's easier for the voters to grasp, the creation of a state education savings fund and the state education funds. I think that the voters can grasp that, and then regardless of where you put the details of that, the other requirements then make more sense after that. You know, the first time I read this, when I'm looking at eliminating the requirement that for the 2011 fiscal year and the fiscal year after, you know, that is something that I think the voters will be confused with initially, and they're going to have to struggle with. I think if you put creating a state education fund savings account in the state education fund up front, then that makes more sense in context. Maybe we disagree on the operation, but I think that for the voters, the more basic concept that they can readily get a handle on initially will cause these others to make more sense.
Well, I appreciate that the voter might get lost in that language, although I came into this hearing thinking that I'd rather just reverse basically lines 3 through 6 with lines 7 through 8. In other words, put the TABOR refunds language first. And I'm not talking about how we say these things, but because these are inherently difficult things, I think, to communicate to voters. But basically, it seems to me we might want to start with saying that that it requires that TABOR refunds be transferred to the state education fund, and then it eliminates the inflationary increases. And they kind of go hand in hand, in my mind at least. But I'd sort of suggest that start with the TABOR refunds.
Well, I you know, again, I think chronology should matter, and so mm-hmm. I respect this. I also think that elimination of the requirement, in other words, number one, as opposed to number two. Think a more drastic change in terms of how it works in practice than is the TABOR change. Since we've got the state refund.
Okay. So let's see. Mostly, your alternative draft, it addresses both the order in which the features are presented, but also there's a number of wording, relatively minor wording changes, I think, that are suggested as well.
That's correct.
We can take a look at those. Questions for Mr. Murray? Thank you. Representative Bruce, would you like to comment on the staff draft or the alternative draft suggested by proponents?
Thank you. I have a lot of problems with the staff draft, but let me first address why the proponents' alternative is not satisfactory. So first, let me butter you up by agreeing with you that taking away something that has provided $3.4 billion worth of tax refunds to the people needs to be at the top, because that's what really this is about. I mean, the rest of it is just, it's a sham. They're taking away inflation plus 1% in the front of the house, and through the back door they're slipping in an educational funding increase from another source. So when they say that education is taking a hit or a sacrifice, along with the taxpayers losing their tax refunds forever, I think that needs to be stated clearly. The proponent said he didn't like having a confusing concept at the beginning of the title. Well, in theory, a confusing concept shouldn't be anywhere in the title. If you can't state a clear title, you shouldn't be setting a title. So to simply say, well, we're going to bury the confusing parts of this measure at the bottom of the text, that's not proper. Historically, I can tell you from 20 years experience this year that the title boards have traditionally placed the important things first. Sometimes they do it in chronological order, but that's because the text lists the most important things first. I don't think it's proper to bury the Tabor refunds or the blow off of the entire Byrd-Arbuckle statutory spending cap, which cannot be altered without voter approval, which this would constitute, apparently, and just have that be just some kind of an afterthought. So that I could conceive of a situation where we could have unlimited state appropriations. There'd be no statutory limit at all, because the money just all gets funneled through the education fund, and it counts, or doesn't count, rather, against the spending, Byrd-Arbuckle spending limit, and that's a gaping hole. Education being something like 40 to 45% of general fund spending right now. And to say that anything that's going to go under the name of education, or again categorical programs, whatever the General Assembly says they are, not limited to education in the current definition of the Constitution. That's significant. So. For those reasons, I don't agree with the proponent's understandable effort to conceal the massive impact of this on the average citizen. I think your job in setting a title is to disclose what this means to me, the voter. That's what it's supposed to be about, not what will allow this to pass by burying it in opaque language in a ballot title. So anyway, I don't like their ballot title. If I can just go back to the staff draft. First, I would suggest on line 2, since the measure affirmatively says categorical programs and public education, I think that it should say, after state funds on line 2, unspecified categorical programs and public education from preschool through the 12th grade. They are adding two things affirmatively. And as I said, one of them isn't limited in the Constitution. It's an open-ended definition. And I think people need to understand that this doesn't involve strictly education. It involves busing children and various other things that are not, a lot of people, you know, lunchroom activities or whatever, a lot of people wouldn't call them education. So I think you need to make it clear, as the measure does on page 2 of the text, that it's these unspecified categorical programs and public education, so that people can learn about where their tax refunds would be going. Regardless of where you put the language that is now on lines 3 through 6, the middle of 6, that is highly misleading. It makes it look like they're doing something for education to increase funding, which is, of course, what the implication of this is. And it isn't increasing funding. It's striking out the inflation plus 1% formula. So it's reducing the current guarantee in the Constitution for funding education. It is reducing it. I don't see how you can suggest that this is providing something, but the gullible, innocent voter is going to say, oh, well, gee, this guarantees more funding for education. Well, actually, it guarantees less funding for education under that formula. So for you to say that it does eliminate a requirement. I guess that's a fair statement, but I think the requirement that's eliminated, that's being struck in the text. Well, I'm not phrasing that correctly, so let me get back to that in a minute. I'll go on to another point. I think I'm mischaracterizing that. I would suggest that the language that is now in line 7, middle of 7 through the middle of 9 about the Tabor Amendment, first, I agree that it should be the first thing after the in connection therewith, because that's where the bulk of the money's coming from. As I said, over a five-year period, it was $3.4 billion. To say that that is less significant than these other changes is obviously incorrect. I think you need to make it clear what that means. First place, simply saying, you notice that the proponent didn't even mention Article 10, Section 20. He mentioned his own article, Amendment 23 article, but didn't even give people a reference to look at what this constitutional spending limit is. And I think, since most people out there are not constitutional scholars, I think they've heard of the Taxpayer's Bill of Rights, the Tabor Amendment. They've heard of, in incessant elections for the last 15 years, about detabering. They ought to know that this is detabering the state in terms of any limit on what it is allowed to keep. This simply provides that the spillover goes to one pet project. So I think that the reference should be to Article 10, Section 20, comma, the Taxpayer's Bill of Rights, comma, which is the official language. It's not a slogan. It's the official title in bold print in the Constitution that people are familiar with. And I would suggest you also put in parentheses after Section 20, Tabor in capital letters, so that people know that that's what would be taken away from them if this measure were to pass. I think they also need to know that the consequence, but what this measure proposes to do is to eliminate forever state refunds of excess revenue that are now guaranteed by the Taxpayer's Bill of Rights. I think that would be a much better description. This isn't a pilot program. It's forever. And the consequence, it isn't just reallocating the money that the state is allowed to spend. It's allowing the state to spend an unlimited amount and saying that your tax refunds forever will be zero. So I think it's better to say eliminating forever all state refunds of excess revenue now guaranteed by the taxpayers, Bill of Rights, parent Tabor, close parent. I don't see why on line 10 of the staff draft you have a portion of, it seems to me it's clearly 10%. I don't know why you would use a indirect term. It isn't going to be any other amount. As I read it, it's not, I don't think it says up to 10%. I think it says, in subsection 6B, it says 10%. So I don't understand why you wouldn't provide that specific information. On line 16, a word like notwithstanding is not really very user-friendly. Got two lawyers on the title board here, and I would suggest you say something like overriding, or if you want to use the word in the Tabor Amendment, weakening, but notwithstanding. And then it says on line 17, again, rather vague phrase, so long as certain obligations are met. What obligations? How do people know what the target is that has to be met before this education funding kicks in? I mean, this is, you know, if you're doing log rolling here, why don't you describe the log that you're rolling instead of just certain obligations, and nobody knows what that means. I don't think that's helpful. In terms of material that's in the text that I think should be disclosed here, there's a language, I think I know what the drafter intended, but I don't think that it came out that way. There's a syntactical problem. On page 2 of the text, line 6C, says the General Assembly shall only appropriate money, only modifying appropriate, meaning it can't sequester, can't save, can't transfer, whatever. It can only appropriate by the enactment of a bill. What it should say is the General Assembly shall appropriate money only by the enactment of a bill. But I just point out to you that this measure is not clear and well written because you have a misplaced modifier there. In the next paragraph on line D, and I'm just bringing paragraph D, I'm trying to bring this up to show you how it relates to having to work through this to come up with a clear title. It says money that would otherwise be corrected to this account would cause the balance of fund monies in the account to exceed an amount equal to 8% of the total amount appropriated in the prior fiscal year by the General Assembly from the General Fund and the Education Fund. Now, 8% of what? Is 8% of the total appropriation, or 8% of the prior year's appropriation, 8% of the fund? I don't think it's, frankly, a very clear formula, but I think you need to wrestle with that to establish what you're talking about. And I think that 8% of the total amount appropriated by the General Assembly, or is it 8% appropriated by the General Assembly for education, 8% appropriated for the fund last year? So 1 year, if it's $10 million, next year can only be $800,000. I don't think that that's clear, and it needs to be clear if you're going to have a an accurate title. I also think, despite the chairman's comment about the, he didn't feel that the bird harvest cow limit was terribly important. It was important enough to put in the first subsection of the Tabor Amendment that it could only be weakened by future voter approval. So I think after the mention that it eliminates forever all state refunds of excess revenue under the taxpayer's bill of rights, it should say also creates an exception to the appropriations limit of any money going to education. And I think that that needs to be not just a parenthetical, incidental, throwaway phrase, notwithstanding any limitations on annual general appropriation, general fund appropriations. Remember, that's the statutory provision that was used to argue against the need for the Tabor Amendment. And that's why the Tabor Amendment incorporated it and required it to only be weakened by future voter approval. So it was important enough for the opponents of Tabor to mention, and the fact that they're taking away this guardrail as well is not just something for a eight-word throwaway clause at the buried at the bottom of the measure with some counterbalance about the guaranteed transportation funding before that occurs. So I think that we need to reorder and rephrase the ballot title that the staff draft has provided and disregard the self-serving one provided by the proponents.
Thank you, Representative Bruce. Don't have anybody else sign up to testify. I think we're going to need to move pretty quickly. It's almost 11:15. This is one of five remaining measures on this morning's agenda. And in order to complete today's work, which we have to do, we're going to need to move pretty fast. Mr. Carton, I guess I would prefer to work off of the staff draft. Is that okay with you?
I agree with that, Mr. Chair. I would point out that CR 1014 from this past session, which number 125 tracks, closely tracks the title of that measure, the chronology, the statement, was perhaps closer to the proponent's suggested revisions, stating creating a state education savings account in the state education fund immediately following the statement of the single subject. But to just jump to the end, I think that the statement of the single subject, and I understand Representative Bruce's argument and assertion about the language categorical programs, I think the statement of the single subject in the staff draft is a good one. Notwithstanding the sequence in the legislature's effort, I'm supportive of the sequence in the staff draft, and I am also supportive, now getting into the details, of your suggestion of moving the Tabor modification to be maybe the first clause succeeding the statement of the single subject.
Okay. Well, let's start with that. Ms. Gomez, maybe if you'd go down to line 7. Let's move that clause that begins in line 7 with the word requiring that any revenue. Let's cut and paste that entire clause that goes through, I think, the first few words of line 9. First three words, I think that clause right there. You could cut and paste that so that it's the first clause after the in connection therewith. And then I maybe as part of this, I think we need to address the reference to Section 20 of Article 10. For the sake of what I like about that is that compared to the proponents' alternative languages, I really do want to focus on the fact that that these are refunds that would otherwise be required. But I also agree that your reference to Section 20 of Article 10 is not very informative. This proponent's alternative referred to constitutional limit on state fiscal year spending, I believe.
It's line 12 of our draft. Line 12.
Okay, thank you. Where I'm going, I don't know exactly what my suggestion is going to be, but where I'm going is I actually would like to include a reference to either Tabor or Taxpayer Bill of Rights. I guess I'd rather not refer to Section 20 of Article 10, but I could live with it as long as we include a reference to either Taxpayer Bill of Rights in parentheses or Tabor in parentheses. In fact, I guess I'm warming up to that idea. I don't know, Mr. Carton, how do you feel about it? Before I go much further, I may be going down the wrong road.
One suggestion would be on line 4, after Constitution, to insert either perhaps a comma, the Taxpayer's Bill of Rights, or in parenthetically, Tabor.
Mm-hmm.
I think at this point, I think that's a good clarification. Not sure which I prefer.
Let's start. Mr. Meyer, do you have a comment on that?
Well, I do. I think that you want simplicity in this, and I think the constitutional limit is simple. Additional language that's longer. I think that our provision addresses exactly the operation of this. Adding more language here. I would prefer to keep Section 20 of Article 10 of the Colorado Constitution, because that's something the voters can refer to. Add a descriptor there. You're adding, frankly, additional language that I don't think is necessary. And arguably, it's in the nature of a buzzword. I understand that it's the article as it's called in the Constitution. But I think my preference would be not to include the statutory or the constitutional provision at all and just say constitutional on state fiscal year spending. I think that's accurate. I think it's short. It provides clarity that is not going to be misleading to voters.
Okay.
Start using Tabor or refund and terms like that, it can be somewhat misleading to the voters.
My suggestion is going to be, Mr. Carton, but before we put that up, see if you would concur. I think I would prefer to use the phrase constitutional limit on state fiscal year spending instead of the citation to Section 20 of Article 10, but I still want to include either Taxpayer Bill of Rights or Tabor. I don't want to do both, but I guess I would suggest let's strike the citation. And let's see, it would say otherwise be required to refund pursuant to the constitutional limit on state fiscal year spending and then in parentheses again, I don't have a parentheses. Although maybe, actually, I like the quotes. You can leave the quotes. Parentheses quote. Yes. Although I might be talked out of that. I guess if I were going to put Tabor, I would put quotes. But at this point, I guess I want to suggest Taxpayer Bill of Rights instead. So let's not have the quotes, Ceci. Sorry. And just say Taxpayer Bill of Rights. Yes, taxpayers. Close paren. So let's see if that's required to refund pursuant to the constitutional limit on state fiscal year spending, paren, taxpayers, bill of rights, close paren, be transferred. Oh. All right. Otherwise be required to refund pursuant to the constitutional limit on state fiscal year spending, be transferred. Requiring that revenue that would otherwise be required be ref. Okay, so I don't know. Okay, is that okay, Mr. Meyer? Quick comment. We've got to move
on. It's a quick comment that now we've referred to the taxpayer's bill of rights, the constitutional limit, but now the average voter is going to read taxpayer's bill of rights unless they've lived here long enough to remember enactment and its progress. They now don't know where to look for that in the Constitution. So that's why I would just leave it as constitutional without the taxpayer's bill of rights. If you're going to have the taxpayer's bill of rights language, I would put back in the section 10 article, or article, put back in the cite to the Constitution with Tabor in quotations just to keep the verbiage down.
Okay. Mr. Bruce, Representative Bruce, very
Thank
quickly.
You. I have no objection. He wants to put in Article 10, Section 20, that's fine, but people don't have their pocket constitutions. If they want to read it, you want to tell them where to read it, they're still going to have to find it somewhere. My point is, I think to let people understand what's involved and what does it mean to me, you should say be required to refund to taxpayers. Let people know that it's they're voting away their tax refunds. It isn't money being required to be refunded to some other state fund or transferred or something. It's a refund to taxpayers that is being voted away in perpetuity. So I think it's important that people don't know where the refund is going that would be given up if you don't tell them. And he's right that there are some new people here that aren't aware because they may have moved here since the refund ceased in 2001. So I would suggest that you had to refund to taxpayers. Otherwise, I think that's a good change. I would suggest that taxpayers' bill rights, since it is a quote from the title, be in quotes.
Okay.
But I think it's more important to tell them that it's to be refunded to taxpayers.
One sentence comment.
Up to the mic, please, then.
The one comment I have is that if you add the phrase refund to taxpayers, you create the possibility of confusion that the voters will think they're not getting their income tax refunds, and that would be a misleading title.
Okay. I think what I want to do is let's have the board members go through their suggested changes to the titles, and then we'll, at the end I'll take comments because we really are just about out of time here. I think that's my motion, as Ms. Gomez has shown it on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 2-0. Further changes to the staff draft. And I think I'm okay with the order, I believe. We've then got the Tabor refunds first, the elimination of the annual increases second, the savings account provisions third, and then I think we end up with the general fund, the possibility of general fund transfers if transportation obligations are met. I think that's the order I prefer. I'm open to suggestions, and then I think there's probably some I want to compare to the proponent's suggested language to see if there's anything that we need to incorporate. I'm not too happy about the citation. We don't have a. Oh, or do we? Have we eliminated citations to the Constitution? I think we have. Okay. I'm sorry. I think the proponents had suggested a citation to Amendment 23, but we're not doing that in the current version.
I guess I would say that the language in line 18, the notwithstanding language, I'm comfortable with that going forward. I understand Representative Bruce's comments on that. Purposes of going forward, that accurately states the purpose of that particular provision.
Okay. Well, right off, I don't see any other suggestions that I'd like to offer. And I think then maybe we'll afford one last opportunity for folks to comment on that, although I think it's probably been commented on. But I'd be prepared to move that as the title set by the board. Understanding we can come back to this on a motion for rehearing if anybody has significant reservations. Representative Bruce.
Thank you. I wanted to make one other pair of related suggestions. When you say an amendment, singular, to the Colorado Constitution, this is amendment to two different articles of the Constitution. I think it should say an amendment to two sections or various sections or something. Happy with two or something, but I think it needs to be clear. There's a lot of controversy now about amending the Constitution. We even have a measure that's going to be in the ballot now to limit constitutional amendments because we're amending them too often. And I think people should know that this is two constitutional amendments, not an amendment, which is, I think, deceiving. An amendment implies it's a singular amendment. People would think it applies to one article or one part. So I think it should say an amendment to various sections of the Colorado Constitution, to two sections of the Colorado Constitution. And then related to that, on line 3, well, let's see, it would now be line 5, put in front of the word requirement the word constitutional. You have constitutional limit on line 4. You should make it clear that it's a constitutional requirement on line 5. And so I think that you need to clarify in the title. You're amending two articles of the Constitution, and that you need to specify, you go ahead and specify one, the Taxpayer's Bill of Rights, and then you don't mention that the other one that's being eliminated is current constitutional requirement. The people who are pro-Amendment 23 ought to know that Amendment 23's formula is being eliminated for annual increases. So I think that that's relevant to tell them that, just as it's relevant to tell the taxpayers on the other side.
Okay, and thank you, Representative Bruce. I think I'm okay with the way we have it. It is an amendment to the Colorado Constitution. I don't think we have normally pluralized that in other cases. I think it is important to say that the TABOR refunds are a constitutional provision. Since it is an amendment to the Colorado Constitution, I don't think it's really necessary to say that we're eliminating the constitutional requirement. So I'm okay with the way it is. Mr. Murray?
Just briefly, we've addressed the order. It is what it is. I think that there's just a little excess verbiage in there that our draft to certain degree takes care of, but I'll leave it to the board's discretion given our short time as to what to do.
Thank you. And I'm going to go ahead and move that the board adopt the staff draft as amended.
Second.
I think in the interest of time, I'm not going to read it into the record. Is there any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye. Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 2-0. And, of course, it maybe goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway, that the same changes would be made in the ballot title and submission clause. That completes action on number 125. The time is 11:31. Let's go on to number 126. And I'm hoping that everyone can incorporate their comments that were made, that each of us made for number 125. and that we can work off of, if we get to setting a title for number 126, that we can work off of the title that we adopted for number 125. Mr. Murray, on behalf of proponents, perhaps you could tell us what the difference is between this measure and number 125?
Certainly. There is exactly one difference. It is reflected in the title. If you look at beginning at line 11 on the draft that's up on the screen there, the draft of 126, requiring a bill to be passed by either a two-thirds majority vote of the General Assembly or any state fiscal year in which Colorado personal income grows less than 6% between the two previous calendar years by a simple majority vote of the General Assembly. That's the difference. There is an additional way in which the General Assembly can access the savings account funds that was not present in 125. It requires a supermajority, except in certain circumstances where a simple majority vote would work. 125 only had the supermajority requirements. So that's the only difference, both in the language of the provision and the language of the title and the ballot title and submission clause. So I will, to speed things up, incorporate all my comments, objections, and other remarks addressing this. I'm fine with just reordering this based on the draft we did for 125, although I would note that probably shorten it if you adopt some of our language.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Bruce, if you, and again to the...
Thank you. I will also incorporate everything that I said before.
Thank you.
I will bring up one item. I realized in my notes I skipped it on the other one, but it also applies here to this new section. There's two problems with the new section here as opposed to just one that I forgot to mention at the other one. If a bill, this is a constitutional requirement, so if a bill is passed by a two-thirds majority of the General Assembly, I assume it's a bill, so it's still under the Constitution, goes to the governor. If the governor vetoes it, and his veto is sustained because upon reconsideration the General Assembly does not have a two-thirds vote in both houses, then what happens? Are we changing the rules? Are we saying that the governor doesn't, that we're taking away the governor's right to a veto, or that if upon reconsideration it gets less than a two-thirds vote in both houses, that it it doesn't qualify as an exception? It also says in the language of the text, this is a new requirement in page, well, let's see, section 6C, and I think it applies in the other poorly drafted portion of the prior version. It does. It doesn't say a two-thirds. Okay. Well, it's not clear to me whether it's a two-thirds majority of all the members elected to each house or a two-thirds majority of the legislature. The language that we have on the screen says a two-thirds majority vote of the General Assembly, which is not what the text says, and the text itself is unclear. So if you have 60 House members and 10 senators, that would be a two-thirds majority of the General Assembly. But that does not conform to the title that you just set on the other one, and obviously doesn't conform to the title you're contemplating setting on this one. So there you have a problem. You might want to reconsider the just adopted petition, have it conform to the text, and on the assumption that it means two-thirds majority in each house of the members.
Okay, thank you.
The other item is this establishes a standard of Colorado personal income, which I do not see defined here. I'm not aware whether it's, maybe that's, I looked in the definition of personal, I looked in the Amendment 23 section, I didn't see personal income I don't think it was defined in the definition section. Maybe it's in there somewhere else. But who decides personal income growth? Unlike Tabor, which defined inflation and said who computes it, there's nothing in here to say who decides personal income growth in the two prior calendar years.
Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and, well, first of all, I don't see any reason why the board would change its finding with respect to single subject. So I'll first go ahead and move that with respect to number 126, that the board find that the measure complies with the single subject requirement and that proceed to set a title.
Second.
If there's no other discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 2-0. And I suggest maybe we just go ahead and substitute for the staff draft the title that was set for number 125, and then I'll suggest a couple of changes to make to that, if that's okay with you, Mr. Carden.
Yes.
So we'll start with the title that we set for number 125, at least in my suggestion here. And then to reflect the difference between 125 and 126, then in line something, 13 of 12, how about requiring, let's see, in line 12, requiring a bill be passed by, and let's insert either, be passed by either a two-thirds majority vote. And although I don't want to reopen what we did on number 125, it seems to me that it would be more accurate to say a two-thirds majority vote of each house of the General Assembly. Would that be okay with you, Mr. Carden? Of the General Assembly, or after a General Assembly, insert or, comma, in any state fiscal year, in which Colorado personal income grows less than 6%. Yes. No, I'm sorry. Words. 6%. Sorry. Between the two previous calendar years, between the two previous calendar years, comma, by a simple majority vote, and of the General Assembly. I don't know whether we need to say of each house, but for just to get this up on the screen, I'm going to suggest using the language of the staff draft that you just say by a simple majority vote of the General Assembly. And then I think the staff draft for 126 picks up the rest to use the monies in the savings account. And I guess that would be the difference in the titles to reflect the difference between the measures. So that would read, requiring a bill to be passed by either a two-thirds majority vote of each house of the General Assembly or, comma, in each state fiscal year in which Colorado personal income grows less than 6% between the two previous calendar years, comma, by a simple majority vote of the General Assembly. And I wonder if we need a comma there, because this is really, there's a lot of words before you get to the meat of this, which is to use the monies in the savings account. Or am I misreading it? The point is, to use the monies in the savings account, you have to pass the bill by either simple majority or two-thirds vote. I don't know whether we need to move that to the beginning of the phrase. Mr. Murray?
And I don't know, it may just be that you just want to flip the clauses there so that after the or, it would say, or by a simple majority vote of the General Assembly in any state fiscal year in which Colorado personal income less than 6%. That may make it easier. About where to use the money.
Well, I guess I'm more concerned about focusing on that language. I'm wondering if it's better to put that clause, to use the monies in the savings account, put it at the beginning of this clause and say, in order to use the monies in the savings account, comma, requiring a bill to be passed by two-thirds or a simple majority. That's kind of what I'm trying to get at, is what's, Mr. Carton?
Maybe you were going this direction, line 12, could you say, and said this, Mr. Meyer, but on line 12, say, requiring a bill to be passed to use the money in the savings account by either a two-thirds.
That might work. Requiring a bill to be well, I don't know, let's see. Yeah.
It accurately states it. It's just
the way it's
distance.
Maybe we just leave it for now. That's the kind of basically the staff draft. And then again, if we can figure out how to improve it later, I think it's. I don't see something necessarily that's an improvement right now. I guess that's my motion.
Second.
All those, and again, this is an amendment to the staff draft. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 2-0. Any other changes to the staff draft? If not, Mr. Murray?
Point out there's an extra word on towards the end of the line. That by simple majority vote and of.
Oh, thank you. It's okay. It would read it by a simple majority vote of the General Assembly, et cetera. Okay, thank you. If there's no other discussion, I'll go ahead and move that that we adopt the staff draft as so amended.
Second.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 2-0, and that concludes action on number 126. The time is 11:45. Representative Bruce.
Thank you. I just wanted, while we're still on the record, to file a motion for rehearing. It's my understanding from reading the statute that would occur within 48 hours of after the deadline, which is a week from today. So it would not occur any time. I mean, I can wait a week to file it, but by filing it now, it will not accelerate the time for rehearing, which has to be 48 hours after Wednesday the 28th.
That's correct. And right. And anybody can within the week can turn in a written motion for a rehearing on any measure to the Secretary of State, and it'll be held within the rehearing will be held within 48 hours after the expiration of the 7 days.
Either the 29th or the 30th.
And I'm anticipating that most likely the board will meet on the morning of the 30th, Friday the 30th. And if we cannot complete our agenda on that Friday morning, then we'll meet the preceding Thursday afternoon.
Okay. And I have contained in here a request, depending on the time that you choose, that I may be allowed to state my objections telephonically, since it is 70 that, miles.
That's part of your motion.
That's it.
Okay. Well, you could give that to Ms. Gomez. She'll have to give that to you later. Okay, then let's go on to the next agenda item. Okay, the next agenda item is 2007-2008, number 96, cost of living wage increase. This is before us on a motion for rehearing. Mr. Friednesch, I think this is your motion. If you'd like to come forward. Are you here?
Yes.
Oh, sorry, there you are, right there. I was still looking in the back for you. And in the interest of time, if you could just emphasize, we have the benefit
absolutely.
Of a written brief.
And absolutely. And I will say today's calendar is maybe the strongest reason for initiative reform in Colorado. Not that that's related to my subject, it's not. The problem with this is, first of all, the single purpose of this is to create a mandate on employers that they provide a cost of living increase based on the consumer price index used for Colorado, for basically everyone in the state of Colorado based on their wages or salaries. That's the stated single purpose. And it's also the single subject of this initiative. The problem is this. There is one basic single subject problem. In subsection 3, it has a much different purpose. And that is, it says, employers, you are prohibited from decreasing wages or salary by the consumer price index used for Colorado. And that is a completely incongruent, separate subject from cost of living increases based on an increase of consumer price index. If you had a depression in Colorado and were probably in a recession, employers are prohibited from decreasing wages. And there's also an interaction between this and Initiative 62 and 76 and the Just Cause Initiative in terms of what that does as not being grounds for, potentially not being grounds for terminating or suspending employees. So I think that is completely separate and distinct. And I think that can't be cured, and it's clearly unrelated. We talked, and I'm going to go real briefly in the interest of time. I think you have my arguments, and you're aware of my other arguments pretty much. I mean, this adds a new administrative remedy, which allows any person in the state to basically file a complaint with the Division of Labor, not necessarily an aggrieved employee, but any person. That was the language of the text. And then the Division of Labor is charged to investigate and enforce that. It eliminates the right to contract for employers, and I think that's tied to decrease in wages and not just the increase in wages. And then my overriding discussion, which I won't go into detail about because I think I've done a significant job and I would incorporate my comments from the last hearing, is that I think it's impossible to set a subject for something that bases itself on a cost of living increase on the consumer price index used for Colorado that doesn't exist. I don't think it matters that it references another amendment that is equally uses the same language, which is equally problematic and doesn't resolve the issue. So I don't know how you set a title. And clearly, in looking at the single subject title of this initiative, it does more than just concerns the annual cost of living increases in employees' wages or salaries. So with that, unless there's questions, I think I've been pretty succinct. for the title board.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Friedenash. And I should have recognized at the beginning that now sitting as the Attorney General's designee is Jeff Blue, who's a Deputy Attorney General with the Attorney General's Office. So, Mr. Blue.
Mr. Friedenash, and I'll again state for the record, for full disclosure, that I used to work with Mr. Friedenash at Fairfield and Woods last year up till the end of December. First thing is your argument that the prohibition against a decrease is a second subject. Isn't that just a clarification of the fact that this has to do with increasing as opposed to decreasing wages with the cost of living?
I don't think so, because it takes action. And it takes action saying, employers, you cannot decrease salaries or wages for employees.
But the title says that it's a that it has to do with increase, you know, cost of living, wage increases for employees. There's nothing in there that would suggest that it's a change based on cost of living. It's just on increases. So to some extent, it seems it's just a clarification to me. So I'm trying to understand how this is a second subject.
I don't think so. I respect your position or your question. My concern is that the heading says this deals with cost of living increases. Single subject is dealing with cost of living increases. It's only dealing with increases in to try to deal with employees who are dealing with rising costs based on the cost of living, whatever the cost of consumer price index being used is. It doesn't matter. The point is that's separate and distinct than saying we're going to tie employers' hands, and now under no set of circumstances can you decrease wages or salary. I think that is different, and I think it's separate.
Any other questions for Mr. Friedenash?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Bella, would you like to respond on behalf of proponents?
Good morning, or is it almost afternoon? Michael Bellow from Barenbaum, Weinschenk and Eason, representing the proponents. I'd like to try to briskly, as I can, cover the topics raised by the opponents in their motion for rehearing. First, the CPI argument is the same argument that was previously rejected by the title board, and there's really nothing new added to that argument. The opponents would apparently prefer that another measure of the CPI might be used rather than the same one used by the Colorado Division of Labor in adjusting the minimum wage under Article 18, Section 15. And as the board well knows, arguments addressed to the merits of the measure are properly addressed to the voters, not to the title board or the Supreme Court at this stage of the initiative. And second, we chose the language, quote, the CPI used for Colorado for two very legitimate reasons. First, it's the same language already used in the Constitution regarding the adjustment of the minimum wage, which is a closely related subject. And second, the proponents want the CPI to be consistent, wanted to ensure uniformity and consistency of the administration of these two complementary and closely related laws. So should the Division of Labor in the future decide to use a different CPI, for example, if the Bureau of Labor Statistics comes up with a CPI that the division deems to be more appropriate, even more appropriate than the current one that they use, then this initiative would allow them to require them to use that CPI. This ensures uniformity and consistency and avoids confusion. Second point, the single subject argument that the opponents are making. It's very inventive to come up with four subjects here, but it's quite wrong. We think the subject can't be stated much more simply. Covered employers shall grant an annual cost of living wage increase, and it will be determined by the CPI used for Colorado. And I think that's about as direct and straightforward as any statement of the subject can be. And the rest of the initiative is directly related to the implementation. And the remedies that flow from this subject. Take the question that the employers cannot reduce wages if the CPI goes down. I think an obvious question that any reasonable person, any reasonable voter, considering the purpose of the initiative, would ask is, Well, what happens if the CPI goes down? Well, this answers that question. It says they're not permitted to reduce wages because the CPI goes down. And I take issue with a particular statement that Mr. Friedmash made just a few minutes ago, saying that this was tying the employer's hands completely and saying that they cannot reduce wages. This just says they can't reduce wages if the CPI goes down. This doesn't deal with other issues here. This just answers that question, which we think would be quite present in the mind of a reasonable voter. And it's clearly related to it. The purpose of this is a wage increase hinged upon the CPI. Should the CPI goes down, it says you can't decrease wages. We think that is very closely related and interdependent with the overall purpose of the initiative. And we remind you, and I'm certainly not trying to patronize the board here, but to violate the single subject requirement, initiative must relate to more than one subject and must have at least two distinct and separate purposes that are not dependent upon or connected with each other. We respectfully submit that the opponents haven't even gotten to the first premise here, showing that it's a separate subject, but they clearly haven't, in our view, reached the second premise to show that these are not interdependent upon and related. Essentially, the obligation to not decrease wages if the CPI goes down is merely two sides of the same coin. And the impair the obligation of contracts argument, I'd like to address that briefly. Now, this is the same argument which used to be used in the early part of the 20th century, the freedom of contract argument that was used initially with some success in the 20th century to strike down federal legislation, child labor laws, maximum hour laws, the so-called sick chicken case that a lot of us know from law school. It was the Supreme Court ultimately rejected this discredited analysis that laws impair the obligation of contracts, the so-called freedom of contract argument. The opponents here could just as easily argue that the minimum wage law impairs the obligation of a contract to pay an employee less than the minimum wage. But the key thing, I think, about the freedom of contract argument is that it's only the court has to interpret it to apply only to vested contractual rights, and the most specific example of that is pension benefits. Colorado Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court have found that once you have a contractual right to receive a certain pension, it's vested. You can't take that away from the employee. However, in the case of Spradling, which is 870 P. Second 521, the Colorado Court of Appeals determined that while the legislation couldn't decrease the pension benefits that had already vested, it could increase taxes. In this sense, there was a tax exemption that they changed.
But Mr. Bell, if I have a contract with my employer today that's written in writing that sets forth a 3-year term, isn't that a vested interest that I have in that contract? And isn't this telling me and the employer that that contract is no longer valid as it deals with wage increases?
Well, my response to that argument is, you could have a contract that you are, one of the cases that was dealt with here, that you are an independent contractor, for example. One of the cases that the court dealt with is called Weitzel Ready Mix. It's 728 P. Second 364, where the company said, we have a contract with this person. It says that he's an independent contractor. And as a result of the workers' compensation statute, it's been determined that he's an employee and we have to pay benefits to him. And the Court of Appeals had no problem in getting over the impairment of contract argument. I think the short answer to that is that's not a vested right. There's no vested right in a contract that says that in 2 years I will pay you, a wage freeze. Let's say that. Just accept that as the premise that you'll have a wage freeze for 3 years. That's not a vested right. It hasn't vested. And the analysis of the impairment of contract depends upon whether there is a vested contract right. That's why it's been limited to questions such as the pension, where there clearly is a vesting that occurs in certain pension programs.
You're saying that if I have a contract with somebody, it's not a vested right?
I'm saying it's not. That some contract rights don't vest until a certain time. This law, of course, would be prospective. And
We're not talking about the contract I make tomorrow. We're talking about the contract
right.
I made yesterday.
I'm saying that's not a vested contract right, as the Colorado courts have interpreted vested contract rights for purposes of the impairment of contract analysis.
Can you say the citation for that is 728 P. 2nd 364?
That's Weitzel is 728 P. 2nd 364, and I think you've got Spradling, which is 870 P. 2nd 521 is Spradling, which deals with it. The courts have potentially the impairment of contract analysis could be used against just about every piece of state legislation that changes in some respect the law. If the state were to pass a law requiring health insurance, for example, which we'll be talking about a little bit later on today, then this argument could be trotted out to say that, well, I have a contract with my employer that says that I don't have to pay health insurance. This impairs the obligation of that contract. And the short answer to that is that's not a vested right. You don't have a vested right when you enter that contract that you're not going to pay health insurance for 3 years. And the court has, I think, interpreted that somewhat narrowly to refer only to such vested rights. So as just as a pension recipient doesn't have a vested right to maintain a particular tax exemption, which is what happened in the Spradling case, then an employer, or I guess you could say an employee, and it's really what boxes scored, it's not likely to be the employee, but employer doesn't have a vested right when they enter into a contract not to pay what the minimum wage requires or what this initiative would require in cost of living increases for the future term of that contract. It hasn't vested. Final argument I'd like to go to, unless, of course, there are questions, is the remedies. These remedies directly implement the purpose of the initiative. They're directly connected to it. And again, the initiative directly answers a question that a reasonable voter looking at this provision might ask, which is, what if the employer doesn't pay the cost of living increase? What then? What do we do? And, well, what we do is either you can make a complaint to the Division of Labor, and they can do an investigation, take enforcement action, or you have a right to civil action. This is taken directly from 86118 and CRS 86119. Those are the implementing provisions for the minimum wage law. Those actually preceded the minimum wage amendment, but they deal with the general minimum wage law of Colorado. This is taken directly adapted from those same remedies. I mean, it's a closely related statute, and it provides for either the recovery by the employee in a suit or the investigation and enforcement action by the Division of Labor. So, directly from that, the remedies are exactly parallel. So the argument that the title set by the board is misleading. Their final argument is almost frivolous. To say that the amendments concerning the way this is stated, it captures all the elements. And let's keep in mind, this is a relatively brief initiative here. And the purpose of the title setting, and some of the cases have so held, is to state things in clear, succinct language. And I think that the title that's been set by the board here does so, and accurately captures all the major components, probably all the components, in fact, of this initiative. So I think the argument that that title is misleading is way off base. So it's our position that you were right in the first place to title this initiative and to give it the title that you did, that the arguments that the opponents have raised are without merit. To reject the motion for rehearing and to maintain the title that they have already issued.
Thank you. Any further questions for Mr. Bellow? Thank you. And Mr. Friedenash, we'll give you a chance. I do want to emphasize that we've got two more measures and we need to take a lunch break in order to come back at 1 o'clock. So, Mr. Friedenash.
Thank you. And I'm not going to cover all this. I've been very short and succinct. The first time up, I will be saying this time. The problem is this is to unrelated purposes. And take that sentence out about prohibiting employers from decreasing wages or salaries. It doesn't need to be in here. It doesn't need to be in here. If it wasn't in here, what you would have is a measure that does exactly what the subject of this seeks to effectuate. Instead, we add it in here, which is a separate purpose. We want to say something different than just nothing. If it wasn't in here, employers and employees would be free to do whatever they want. Because it's in here, it's doing something specific. It's creating an affirmative duty on employers not to decrease wages or salaries due to a decrease in the cost in the consumer price index. That's a fundamental flaw, and it's a separate, distinct purpose that has nothing to do with the cost of living wage increase. And that's the problem. I'm not going to go into a discussion on the whether or not, with respect to the ability to contract, whether it's a fundamental right. I will say, though, that there have been numerous cases that have held these initiative process reviews that implied repeals are a separate subject. With respect to the last argument, I will just say our fundamental basic problem with this is twofold. One, it doesn't discuss the two things, the two purposes of this proposed initiative in the single subject statement, number one. And number two, there's no such thing as consumer price indexes for Colorado. That's the fundamental problem. And just referring it to another initiative that has the same problem and has been interpreted the only way the Division of Labor could, given the fact there's no such thing, doesn't fix the problem.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Friedenash. Discussion by the board? Mr. Bellow, very briefly.
I just want to address one comment that Mr. Friedenash made, that if this restriction on the employer reducing wages if the CPI should decrease were not in the initiative, it would be it's not necessary, he's saying. Well, if it were not in the initiative would be ambiguous. That would be the question that would be asked. And we're trying to make we made it definite. So we think it is essential and closely related to the purpose.
Actually, Mr. Bell, I'm sorry, and I'll be quick. I know we're trying to get through this, but I'm struggling with a problem here, and that is twofold. And the first piece is I'm not sure it would be ambiguous without that statement because it talks about increases, and so it doesn't talk about decreases, so I think it's very clear that it is only increases, so I'd like you to address that. The second piece is I'm wondering what happens in a downturn. Say we have a recession, the cost of living is negative, increases are the COL, the delta is negative, and a company decides to decrease wages, but does it not related to the percentage of the cost of living? Is that permitted by this?
I'll answer that second question. This is specific to not causing a decrease based upon a decrease in the cost of living.
So you're saying that a lawsuit would be a factual-based question of did they do it because the cost of living went down or because the economy soured?
I think it could be like many discrimination cases. The question is, what was the motivation? Was the motivation that they decreased it because of the decrease in the cost of living? Was the motivation because they decreased it because they're losing money and they've shown that they've lost money and they can't pay the wages? And it'd be like many other types of discrimination or other suits where a motive is in question and circumstantial evidence and other evidence is considered in determining whether that was improperly motivated.
Thank you.
As to the first question, I just respectfully disagree that I think it would be more ambiguous without this, if this provision were in it. But beyond that, I think that the most important question is that this is a closely related mechanism or issue. That is what happens when CPI decreases. So I think that it's closely connected, regardless of whether the board or I would view it to be maybe more ambiguous or less ambiguous without it. It is such a closely connected point that it is well within the single subject rule.
Okay, thank you. Discussion by the board. Mr. Garten.
Just really very briefly, I'm going to incorporate my kind of basis for finding that the measure is a single subject last time, and with all due respect to Mr. Friedenash, I don't think it's, I think it is reasonable to find that the annual wage or salary increase is connected with the prohibition on the reduction of wages or salaries due to a decrease in the cost of living. I, I don't think it's unreasonable to find. I do think there's a relationship there. I think you can find a relationship there. I think that there is a that they can be reasonably characterized as necessarily connected. And so I think the title, as drafted the first time through, is a good one.
And I agree. I mean, I'm not persuaded that the measure has more than one subject, or that the title set by the board last time were unfair or misleading. But so I'd support a motion to deny the motion for rehearing. Mr. Blue?
I have to say that after hearing the arguments, I would agree that this is a single subject. Although I think that the inclusion of the language regarding the decrease in the CPI is irrelevant, I think that it's still including it doesn't make it a second subject, because at the end of the day, I think they're closely connected. As to the issue with the constitutional repeal, I think that that's the whole point of this measure, is that it is addressing the right to contract in employment. And so I think I don't think that the voters are going to be confused by that. I think that it's not really something that they're not expecting, because that's what the whole point of this measure is. So I don't think that that creates a second subject. So I will move to deny the motion for rehearing.
Second.
Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. That concludes action on number 96, and the time is 12 p.m. Let's turn to number 93.
Safe workplace.
This is before the board on a motion for rehearing. And Mr. Friednash, I think you submitted the motion for rehearing, and you were admirably succinct on the last agenda item. So I'm looking forward to the same.
My taking you on further.
That's right. I will do the same here. I'm not going to go through everything. I assume you have read petitions for rehearing. Let me, it's interesting. Last issue we dealt with, whether something needed to be clarified because it was ambiguous, and here we have a policy that creating this new safe and healthy workplace, and none of those terms are defined, and nothing is left up to the General Assembly to implement that or define that as the health measure is that deals with major medical health care coverage. You'll hear in a little bit. So we have this kind of anomaly that on one hand we need to define things, and the next one we can create a initiative that's so unclear, so vague, voters really won't know what they're voting on. And I think that's essentially one of the biggest problems with this initiative. Another big problem with this initiative is that the policy, again, is to create the safe and healthy workplace. Really what this is trying to do, and it's not listed in here, is it eliminates the exclusivity provisions of the Workers' Compensation Act. The Workers' Compensation Act has been in Colorado since 1919. Briefly, as the petition for rehearing states, the cornerstone of this was that it was a statutory provision that declared an employer who has complied with the provisions of the Act shall not be subject to any other liability for death, personal injury to any employee, and all causes of action, actions of law, suits in equity, proceedings, and statutory and common law rights and remedies for and on account of such death or personal injury to any such employee and accruing to any person are abolished except as provided. That's under Color Revised Act 8-41-102. I think it's important to point out the exclusivity provisions of the Workers' Compensation Act were the quid pro quo of the scheme, which created this no-fault system preventing actions from being brought in common law. This completely abolishes that. That's hidden in the initiative. But it completely abolishes it, and it says, from now on, you have a choice, and your choice is, do you want to go to the workers' compensation system, or do you want to be able to file a civil case for unlimited damages, basically compensatory, punitive damages, pain, suffering damages, which aren't allowed by the workers' comp system. And I don't think voters are going to know that that's what they're voting for. And I'm also confused by the language of the paragraph 3, the very last sentence. that says in the text, and then I'll talk about the title. It's the very last sentence of the title. Now let's start with the title. It says, but prohibiting injured employees from recovering any damages for which the employee already received compensation pursuant to the Workers' Compensation Act of Colorado. In the text, it talks about provide that the employee shall not be entitled to double recovery for the same losses for which the employee has already been compensated in the Workers' Comp Act. I think there may be a difference between losses and damages, but I guess the question I have as a voter is this saying you can get some damages for some injuries, but you can get other damages? I don't think the intent was, and I think we need some clarification, but I don't think the intent was to create a system where you can do both. I think it was clearly intended to create a different avenue, a much more financially viable alternative for an injured employee to pursue any kind of injury anywhere it may take place, on your way home, on your way in, you know, on your way to lunch during the job. I don't know what workplace means, but I think that was the goal of this, but I'm not sure the title of this is that clear, or the text. So with that, unless there's specific questions, I, as promised, I'd keep my comments succinct, and I'll rely on the rest of my brief, and I appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Friednesh. Any questions? Not. Mr. Bellow, very briefly.
I'll talk fast like the Federal Express guy in commercials years ago, but the single subject issue, they somehow derive three separate subjects out of an initiative that has one simple, straightforward purpose: to require the employer to maintain a safe and healthy workplace and to provide a remedy to an employee who was injured if the employer doesn't. And they make the same error, a fundamental error, of disregarding the established law that because an initiative spells out the details related to its implementation, and so long as those procedures have a necessary and proper relationship to the substance, that does not constitute a second subject. I'm not sure if I cited these cases before, but there's at least four cases right offhand I can cite. 962 P. Second 927, that's ballot title 1997-98, number 74. In re-ballot title 1999-2000, number 256, that's 12 P. Second 927. There is ballot title 20506-7, or number 73, that's 135 P. Third 736, Colorado 2006 case. And another companion case, ballot title 2005-06, number 74, 136 P. Second 237. They've all said that the mere implementation or enforcement details directly tied to the initiative single subject do not in themselves constitute a separate subject.
Mr. Bell, let me focus you for a second here, because I think that the concern that I have with this ballot measure is the one raised by Mr. Friednesh, that what essentially this does is this is subjecting employers, it's eliminating the quid pro quo that was created with the Workers' Compensation Act without being clear to the voters that it's eliminating that quid pro quo, and opening up a whole new avenue without the voters knowing that what it's doing is changing that relationship between employers and employees. And I'd like you to address that, because I think that that's a well-founded concern, and I'd like to hear your arguments.
Okay, and that I did definitely want to address that. First, I would say that to claim that this is hidden in the body of the initiative is false. This first sentence of the third section of this initiative says failure of an employer to comply with its obligations under this section shall be actionable by an injured employee in district court in addition to any rights the employee may have under the Workers' Compensation Act. And that clearly spells out that this is in addition to the rights that the employee may have under the Workers' Compensation Act. Then in the last sentence of that same paragraph, it talks about he can't receive a double recovery for the same losses. For example, if the employee's medical benefits are paid, he couldn't receive a double recovery. If the employee received lost time from work, what they call total temporary disability benefits, then that would be something that he couldn't recover in a civil action. So this is, it's just disingenuous to say that this is buried somewhere in the provision when it's right there on the face of it in the first sentence of Section 3. Now let's talk about the exclusivity issue a little bit. In the first place, the word exclusivity is not used any place in the workers' compensation statute. That's a lawyer's word. In fact, I dare say that many lay people, if the word exclusivity were in this document or in this initiative, they would be scratching their heads, what do they mean by exclusivity? What we've done is stated it more simply, that it shall be in addition to any rights that the employee may have. So it's quite clear in the face of our provision and in the title that this is in addition to the rights that he may have, or he or she may have. It's plain English. It's more, it's clearer, more understandable than the word exclusivity. And let me try a formulation that they would probably suggest. In the first sentence of paragraph 3 would be, failure of employer to comply with its obligations under this section shall be actionable by the employee in district court, notwithstanding the exclusivity provisions of the Workers' Compensation Act. Now, I ask you to take off your lawyer's hat for a minute and think that if a voter were to look at that, is he more likely to be misled or confused about that than he or she would be by reading the language we've got? So I think the word exclusivity, while it's a term that we as lawyers use regularly, is not required to be in this statute, because it's not even used in the workers' compensation statute anywhere, and because it's covered, because it's clear from this act, from the language of the proposed initiative. So I'm just responding to that question, but I one or two other points. Well, and that was really primarily what I wanted to discuss. I mean, it's really simple. Safe and healthy workplace. If you're injured, you can file suit, and it's in addition to rights you have under the workers' compensation statute, but you can't get a double recovery. I mean, those are all one integral whole, closely related, interdependent upon each other. We believe that, again, the title board was correct when it initially set the title, and that the title as set faithfully reflects the terms of the initiative.
Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Bellow? Mr. Friedenash, do you have anything further?
No.
Then I'll turn to board discussion on the motion for rehearing. Any discussion by the board?
Sure. I'm troubled by the impact this has on the Workers' Compensation Act and the fact that it's not clear in the measure that it is going to change the nature of compensation for workers when they've been injured in Colorado. I think the measure could have been a lot clearer on that point. Frankly, at this point, I'm struggling which way I'm going to vote. I have to be honest about that. I think at this point I'm not, and I'm curious to what the rest of the board thinks about it, but I'm certainly on the fence, because I think that it's this kind of change. I don't think the average person is going to read this initiative and realize the impact this is going to have on the Workers' Compensation Act.
I don't think I have a problem with the measure as a single subject question. And to the extent that any measure is maybe unclear on something, then of course I generally think that's beyond our purview, except to the extent that we have to understand a measure well enough to conclude that it has a single subject, and we know that lots of times there are effects on other laws that that we don't necessarily have to determine. Cutting straight to Mr. Blue's point, it may be that we do need to include something in the title, though, that reflects the fact that the measure says that it's in addition to any other. To any rights an employee may have under the Workers' Compensation Act, and if that's not clear in our titles, I'm open to including that. But otherwise, I tend to think that the titles that we've set are pretty clear and fair.
I agree with that. I raise some issues, but I also feel as though Mr. Bellow has ably responded to those issues, and in my mind the measure has a single subject. I'm willing to explore modifying the title if that addresses some concerns of the other board members, but as far as the motion goes, subject grounds or the allegation that it violates the single subject requirement, I support denying that particular aspect of the motion.
I guess I'm just wondering. I'll raise the possibility if the question is, could we amend the titles to reflect the impact on the workers' compensation law? Now, I'm wondering if the place to do that would be in between where the title currently says that that the measure enables employees to file suit in district court and recover compensatory and exemplary damages, et cetera, et cetera. And then the next clause says, but prohibiting recovery also an additional, you know, recovering from under the Workers' Compensation Act. I mean, it may be that, I'm just trying to think this through, that where we say that we are prohibiting basically a double recovery, if we were to say providing that such recovery, the recovery that this measure provides for, that such recovery is in addition to the rights the employee may have under the Workers' Compensation Act, but prohibits injured employees from recovering, and I'm picking back up the language of the measure. I mean, it's like I say, you could still recover under workers' comp, but you can't recover under both is the way I understand it.
So I have to say, I don't think that's what this does.
Okay.
My reading on this is that I think you can get your workers' compensation losses, and then you can bring a lawsuit and get your non-pecuniary losses. And so what this does is it actually encourages people to get their workers' compensation losses and then go to court and get more money. So I think that's how a court will read this, not preventing somebody from getting additional damages. It just says that basically the employer is going to get an offset on the workers' compensation benefits that the employee gets. I think that's a legitimate reading of this. That's my concern, and that's why I think that this, the result of this, is probably not a single subject.
Brief comment, Mr. Friedrich.
I guess the concern I have is exactly that. It doesn't say same claims, it says same losses. There's a big difference, and I think that's a significant difference. I don't know how you fix that in the title, because I think this is one of the things that is unclear. And that's the problem. I think it could have said, if the goal of this initiative was to prevent double recovery from different arising out of the same injury, it doesn't say that.
I mean, I think that if the point of this was to prevent what I just suggested, they would say that the initiative would say something along the lines that once you receive workers' compensation benefits, you can't go to court. But it doesn't say that.
And if I could respond, that's correct. This says in addition to.
Right.
This is not intended to say that you have an option or an election, that you either go to workers' compensation or you go to your civil lawsuit. It says that in addition to the rights you may have, provided that you may not have a double recovery for the same losses, you can also go to district court. And so this, I mean, that's not a single subject issue to me. I would tend to agree with that. Maybe we could tweak the language to use the phrase "in addition to any rights," perhaps at some appropriate place. That might make it. I think it's clear, but it could make it clearer to the voters. But I don't think that's a single subject issue. I think that's just a matter of phrasing the titles slightly differently.
And we could address that possibly by saying in line 5 on the screen, and I'll read starting on line 4, because of an employer's violation of this requirement, comma, in addition to any benefits they receive under the Workers' Compensation Act, comma, to file suit in district court. That is very clear to me about what this is allowing to happen, allowing them to get their workers' compensation benefits and then to go into court and get additional damages.
Well, I guess I'm having second thoughts about trying to clarify this, that we may end up confusing things. I mean, it seems to me, I'll make a pitch the other way, that, I mean, as the measure provides, we've said that the act enables people to just bring an action in district court and recover damages. It does, and to the extent the question arises about is this in a, is, can you still pursue your workers' compensation rights, nothing in the measures says you can. In fact, it says it's in addition to that. I think the heart of it, though, is that you can't, you cannot recover for both. That if you sue under both, you're not going to get double recovery, and we've said that in the titles, I think. Mr. Friednesh?
Yeah, I may be fighting a losing battle that's never stopped me yet, but I will say I don't think this captures what the text of the initiative does, and that's my concern. I start off by saying my reading of it suggests I had a much different understanding of this than what was being offered, and I think voters are going to be confused. There's a difference, again, between damages and losses and causes of action. This says damages, the text says losses, for example. Damages would suggest an award to an attorney, at least. I don't know in terms of, you know, the average voter, but to each of us, I think, damages has a special meaning. I think it needs to clearly articulate the fact that, and I'm, trust me, I'm not trying to drag this on, I think you know that, that look, you get your workers' compensation damages, whatever they are, and then you're entitled to additional damage, that you can sue for additional damages, for pain, suffering, punitive damages. These are things that aren't covered by the workers' compensation system. I think, and it's really hard to clarify that in a way that really expresses what this does, but it really does allow double dipping through the system. And I think that is a separate subject.
Let me, in the interest of moving this forward, so let me make a statement, and then actually I'm going to make a motion. In Mr. Friednesh's brief, he quotes from the statute that says that the title should provide a brief statement that fairly and accurately represents the true meaning and intent of the proposed text. So in other words, you don't have to follow the language of the initiative. You got to tell the voters what the true meaning and intent of the initiative is. I think by putting the language in or something similar on line 5 that I suggested, you get a lot closer to telling the voters what the true meaning and intent of the proposed text of the initiative. In the interest of moving this forward, I'll make a motion that we insert language there similar to what I said, and we'll work that out if my motion passes. But the point being, at least we'll find out where the board is on that issue. So I'll move that we insert some language there to clarify that a employee can get benefits under the Workers' Compensation Act and then file suit.
Okay, although I think it's a real close issue, I think I'm not going to second the motion just because I just don't think it's that significant. The fact that the measure does clarify that the rights under this measure are in addition to the workers' comp, I don't think that's significant that we should put that in the title. As long as we have I do think what's significant is that you don't get the double recovery, and that I think we've said. So I'm pretty much still okay with the titles the way we have them.
I agree with that, and I appreciate the motion, but I guess in some ways I look at the precedent that says that the title need not spell out every detail, and I don't think that particular addition is necessary under the circumstances.
Well, I think it's a real close call, but I think that motion dies for lack of a second then. I think I'll go ahead and move then that the motion for rehearing be denied.
Second.
Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye. Aye. All those opposed, no.
No.
That motion carries 2-1. That completes action on number 93. The time is 12:25 p.m. I'd like to quickly move on to the last agenda item for this morning's agenda, and then we really do need to take a break, a lunch break for people that are continuing on. And we're doing, I'll move on to number 2. My understanding is the proponents are not present. This is 2007-2008, number 2, prayer time in public schools. Even though the proponents are not present, I think we can proceed. It's kind of at their peril if there are questions or concerns that they're not here to answer, but it seems to me that the measure is a single subject.
I just want to raise one concern I have with it. I think they made a drafting error in it, and I want to raise it. Sub C, when it said this measure shall commence at the beginning of each school day. Mm-hmm. This measure in this thing refers to the actual initiative, not to the prayer time or the private meditation time. I'm a little concerned about how that impacts this, and I would like to hear the other board's members' thoughts on that.
I saw that too. I guess my first comment would be, I'm not sure that's something that board could modify within its authority to do technical fixes, and I'd be especially reluctant to do that in the absence of the proponents being here. And I guess where I'm going to go with that is that eventually, in order to make the thing work, I think they're going to take the reading, they're going to read it so that it doesn't have an absurd result, and they'll read it as the private meditation beginning commences rather than the measure itself. So that's kind of where I was at.
But you don't think that that creates a impossibility to set title?
I don't.
I'm troubled, as you can imagine.
I'm not sure what it means by the measure being perpetual either, but I
think that's kind of throwaway because we all are, to a large extent, unless they have a sunset provision.
True.
And I agree. There's one or more drafting errors, but I think the measure can. I don't think they rise to the level of problems where we can't set titles. I think it's a single subject, and that presumably, as Mr. Carton says, I think that particular drafting issue can be resolved by interpretation if the measure passes.
Good point in paragraph D as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think the should be they.
Mm, good point.
That's something we can fix, because that's right. And that, can we ask council about that?
Historically, we've only done it at the request of the proponents based upon the Supreme Court ruling that said that's mm-hmm. the way it has to be done.
We won't touch it then, I guess.
I'm going to offer a motion that the board find that number 2 is a single subject and proceed to set titles.
Second.
Any discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Let's turn to the staff draft, which Ms. Gomez has displayed on the screen. Any comments on the staff draft? I guess I would suggest that we strike the word concerning. Even though I understand it's kind of the format, this one is, I know it's radical coming from me. If we're not going to say concerning a requirement of something like that, then I think this is one that's short enough that we can just say what the measure does, and we've done that sometimes. So it seems to me it'd be sufficient to say that it's an amendment to the statutes requiring public schools to provide students, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I guess I'll move that in the staff draft we strike the word concerning in line 1.
Second.
Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. The motion carries 3-0. Any further discussion or amendments to the staff draft?
I move that we adopt the staff draft.
Second.
Make the same draft into the submission clause.
Second.
That's been moved and seconded. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. That concludes action on number 2. The time is 12:41, and we are in recess until.
I think come back after, but I would suggest you don't start for at least half an hour.
I think we won't start until 1:50 for anybody who's listening out there. So, okay. We're in